This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and I am here with Jason Gebhard and his brand new book of poems, winner of the Washington Writers Publishing House 50th Year Editor's Prize, a big deal. Jason, read us a poem.
Thank you, Grace. So my first poem is called Goldfish, and we had a goldfish for the longest time. My children probably don't remember life without the goldfish. And unfortunately, when this poem was published, shortly after the goldfish passed on. So I don't know if the publication did him in or not. But anyway, this is Goldfish. Goldfish. Now the light is on. Scales catch the sudden brightness, glint as the fish glides through what must be like air. Circling the few gallons it has, it bobs down, mouths a pebble, spits, repeats. It surfaces, lips working against the water's limit. Lips open, shut, as if saying, hello, hello, to my big face peering down. I tell my children, everything it does as if for the first time. That it can't get bored or go crazy. They aren't old enough to remember when the fishbowl wasn't here. The goldfish, like the sidewalk, this house, their father, has always been. Its ever-open eyes, glistening with an absence that takes you in. You want to fill it with something, like a story.
Oh, and you do. The poet Jason Gebhard does. Everything it does as if for the first time. And that is the story of the poet's life. What did it feel like to win, and why do you think you won?
I was so thrilled. And the Washington Writers Publishing House is really, they're a wonderful group. And they work together to choose the work that they publish, and then you kind of become part of the group to help perpetuate the work of the press. I'm not 100% sure why I won. I sent it many times, and I was a finalist several times. So I think I finally just beat them down into submission. They decided, we've got to take this book.
I'm sure. But they could outlast you, you know, so there has to be some merit in it. So did they say anything good about it when you won?
I'm trying to think of, I think they liked the notion of focusing on the small things, the family.
Say enough. The small things are the big things, aren't they? That's the poet's job. You do that so well.
Thanks,
you
Chris.
Notice the goldfish as if for the first time. That is your Ars Poetica. Okay, so now that we have you and we're going to have a taste of the book, what's the title?
It's called Dictionary of Air.
It
comes from it comes from a line in one of the poems, which actually I'm going to read. I think it's the last poem.
Mm-hmm. How did you come upon that?
That poem is called Nectarine, and somehow I came to that line, and I remember sharing it with my teacher, David Keplinger, and he was like, he said, oh, that's the title of your book. And then I remember I brought the book to him when I was working on it, because he helped me out tremendously. And I said, David, this book is, I'm going to call it Dictionary of Air, like he said. He says, oh no, not this book. This isn't Dictionary of Air. And he gave me some other titles.
Oh, that is so great. It shows the poet's journey.
Yes.
Doesn't it? But he was right the first time.
Yeah.
Give us two poems together so we really hear your voice, and set them up a bit so we know what we're going to expect.
Okay, so these are two poems. The next two poems are sort of about gestation and origin. The first poem is called Ultrasound. And after our first child, my wife and I had a couple miscarriages. And we were waiting. She was pregnant again with my second child, our second child. And I remember when she was pregnant, we were very anxious because we were worried, you know, would he come to term? So this poem came out of that. It's called Ultrasound. Before your mother wakes, I press my ear to her belly, so I can be alone with you. My ear to the skin, the sonographer's wand passed over, releasing your heartbeat, tracing your body, lemon-sized, in shadows, made of sound. You'll be here come autumn, I almost whisper, but I know so little. I spoke to the one who came before you, your sister, read to her, played music, and how silently she left, her fingers printless, her last beat near still. Its vibration didn't sound, only echoed back to her mother's body, telling it, let go.
What an awesome last line.
Oh, thanks. So the next poem is called J. Edgar Hoover. And my, there's a lot of setup for this, but, my grandfather and my father were FBI agents, and they were both, they started out as brick agents, as they call them, and they worked their way all the way to the top. So my grandfather was sort of at the you know, top of the heap, but he got to a point where he was the, they call the special agent in charge, which is the top person in San Francisco. And when my father was in high school, and you know, Hoover ran the bureau, so he, if someone was getting moved to that level of position, he was in charge of it. So he moved my grandfather from San Francisco to Springfield, Illinois, which is where my mother is from. So my dad had to pack up, move from San Francisco to the middle of Illinois, nowhere for him. And that's where my parents met. And the funny thing is, I have ended up in Washington most of my life, off and on. And my current place where I live is actually just around the corner from where J. Edgar Hoover lived and died. So I would walk around. I found his house. And when my son was a toddler, we would walk around the neighborhood. And this cat would start following us. And it would kind of pester us. And we... And I was a little scruffy-looking cat, and for some reason it popped in my head, you know, he's come back for me, J. Edgar Hoover. Anyway, so there's a lot of references in here. I can't explain them all, but if you know anything about the FBI and Hoover and all the rumors about him, you'll know. So J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar, it's you. Stuffed inside that scruffy tabby cat, stalking us along the sidewalk. My son reaches for your whiskers, and I rush to collect him up in my arms. You arch your back and rub your ribs against my calf. The years roaming the blocks, peeking through basement windows, the ankle view. You were so accustomed to peering down on your subordinates, movie stars, even presidents, working them like marionettes. It's this loneliness, so unfeline, that's blown your cover. But look how far you've ranged from your heart attack house, May 1972, your death month, the month before I was born. A colonial on that short stretch of 30th Place I jog by now and then, right around the corner from where I live. Solar panels jut from the roof now. Hibiscus flank the doorstep. A late model Subaru hitched to the curb. I picture your ghost spinning through the living room in a scarlet sequined party dress. Then imagine you riding shotgun, Clyde at the wheel, heading for Connecticut Avenue and your nightly supper at the Mayflower. Whiskey sours, steaks well done. Mr. Hoover, now so small, shaggy, alone, and my son and I obligated as a family at Thanksgiving to stroke your coat. It's been so long since we shuffled past each other in that great green room above. Gestational me, soon to go on. You, a purpling soul, exiting, not recognizing my likeness to my grandfather. A G-man, you transferred from the San Francisco office to Backwater, Springfield, Illinois, my mother's hometown. You might as well have been prowling the high school library stacks and planted at my mother's study table, the exact book the new kid my father was after, so his eyes could look up from the volume into hers. It might as well have been you who lowered me, hand over hand, through cumulus herds, down toward those tractor-cut fields into June.
Oh.
So I might not have been here if it weren't for J. Edgar Hoover.
Dip, but the scruffy cat, you didn't take it home.
No, I knew. I found out where the scruffy cat lives. In fact, it's still alive. I couldn't believe it.
The homage is so wonderful. To have reduced this man of mass proportions to a homeless little cat. That is a great poem.
Oh, thanks.
Because he was a horrible man.
He did some pretty rough
and
things.
And so
yeah.
If people wanted to reincarnate him, they might well make him an alley cat. And you mm-hmm. did.
Yeah, I'm not sure my grandfather would be too pleased with me, but...
But look at the power of the poet. We can change the narrative. Mm-hmm. That is so good.
Thank you.
If people say to you, you know, I'm hearing these different poems, does your book have a theme?
Mm-hmm.
Then what would you say?
So I guess I thought about that, and I think, you know, a lot of it is about, you know, sort of, it's sort of held by my life as a parent, I think, and a lot of the poems come from my kind of reflecting on being a parent. I was a stay-at-home parent for many years, and so I think a lot of the poems arrive from close attention to when you're a parent like that, you're attending to things very closely, and so I think that's
yes. There is a great noticing in these poems, but as far as the craft, I enjoyed mm-hmm. you enter this each stanza in a different way, which is electricity. And you always end your line on an important word. I don't know if you're aware of this, but mm-hmm. George Bill Gayer says, always end the line on a strong word. Is this unconscious, or did you know that as a matter of craft?
Probably. No, I'm pretty unconscious, I think, about most things. I mean, I think oftentimes I'm probably arriving at something best if I don't know exactly what I'm doing. In fact, I think I even have a poem in which I quote this this great Zen story where it's famous, people know it, where a traveler shows up and he's talking to the teacher, and the teacher asks him, you know, hey, where are you going, or you know, why are you going? And he goes, I don't know. and the teacher says just simply, not knowing is the most intimate. As in not know, and
it
I think
true.
Of it, not knowing is as close as you can get.
And that is like we call the beginner's mind.
Right, a beginner's mind.
That's
the
what David always
Roshi,
says.
Yeah.
But this mm-hmm. is, but there is something called craft.
Right.
And it's how you know to end the line and to begin the next line of the stanza. You have a real beautiful flow. Never is it like boxcars clanging against each other.
Oh, thanks.
So you're either, are you a dancer?
No.
Yogi?
I'm the farthest thing from a dancer.
Well, maybe that's where you do it, on the page.
All right.
Let's have two more.
Okay, great. Thanks. So I started writing prose poems at one point, and then I shared them again with my teacher, David, and who also is a great prose poet.
Mm.
He's amazing. And he gave me some, first of all, he liked them, and he sort of encouraged me and gave me some, taught me a lot about them. So I'm going to read a couple of the prose poems. The first one is called Provenance. The facade of the antique shop is that of a blacksmith's cottage. A few new things are for sale. Toy rifles cut from pine and sanded smooth. Jars of candied flowers. Postcards on a rotating display. One picturing this very store. The shopkeeper in her blacksmith's wife's costume has taken a break from explaining the provenance of things. Behind the counter, she sits uncomfortably in a spindleback armchair and scrolls through her phone to catch up on the news. There, her country is making of itself a wide-open mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the next one, my son had this nightmare that was recurring, my youngest son, and he had a name for it, but he wouldn't tell me what he was afraid. If he told me, what it was, that it would somehow keep coming, and maybe if he didn't tell me. So, and he called it La Mano Blanca. He was in a Spanish immersion preschool at the time. So the La Mano Blanca means like the white hand, which of course is pretty scary sounding, right? The other thing about this poem is it kind of jumps around. That's one of the things about prose poetry I think it can do. And I had at this around that time decided, hey, what the heck, I'm going to look up my what was on the front page of the Washington Post the day I was born. So I looked it up, which was June 1972. So there's a lot of things that could be on there, right? Watergate, all kinds of stuff. But the day was, on above the fold was a picture of Earth shot from the moon. So, and below the fold was that horrible, famous photograph of the girl in Vietnam who had been hit by napalm and was on fire. So this poem is called The Fold. We don't really have a fold in the newspaper anymore, but...
Do we have... We don't have a newspaper anymore.
Right. Well, I mean, some people still get it, but... But here's The Fold. My son has named his recurring nightmare La Mano Blanca, though he refuses to tell me this its story. He believes if he keeps it to himself, the dream will lose its footing as it climbs the cliff face of his sleep, and one night plummet down a forever crevasse. As a whale's corpse sinks, it offers its body to animals of each depth. Sharks at the surface tear the skin. Floor dwellers portion the bones. Online, I look up the front page of my hometown paper the day I was born. Above the fold, new view of Earth. Below, a photo captioned, Vietnamese girl runs in agony after ripping off her clothes, burning with napalm.
Yes, we don't have to sleep to have nightmares, do we?
No.
But what I like about your prose poem, and people say, nobody thinks they know what the prose poem is, but I do.
Oh, great. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
I know that Valerie invented it. Mm-hmm. And I know what it has to do. Mm-hmm. This has come from not doing it right all the time. Uh-huh. And that is the internal lines have to have some lyricism.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
not prose.
No.
And that is from repetition, dream, plummet, depth. That's from repetition of consonants mm-hmm. and the vowels. And that is, as you say, done unconsciously, fortunately, or we couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But the prose poem is literally a poem. Just because it's margin to margin, I don't want people to get scared
mm-hmm.
because you have really used those recurring, redundant consonants, sleep, plummet, and depth, earth, those THs. Mm-hmm. So that's everybody, that's the what a prose poem is.
I think also sometimes to impose a form on it, I've, you know, I have like about a half hour in the morning which I can write, so I get up and I sit down and I say, I can do about 100 words in that time. So what if it works. And so I say, I'm going to write six, most of these are about six, this one's seven, but there'll be six lines across. I try to make it so it's almost like a rectangle. And so, I mean, there is a almost like a kind of an external pressure on it.
But then, yeah. A compression of some mm-hmm. sort. However, how do you get the lilt inside of the line? That comes from you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, I mean, that's what
that's
form,
innate.
I mean, like a lot of the, you know, we talk about how people, what is Stanley Plumlee used to say to us, that form is your mother and your father, you can't escape it, you know, how,
I knew him, obviously.
And he was, he would pronounce. But I think it's true. You need it.
You need the form. Aperture and you do need structure. Mm-hmm. But within mm-hmm. the line is the most important
right.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has to have a sprung
right.
syllable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now you, in addition to being a poet, are a teacher.
Uh-huh.
Tell us about your profession.
So I said that I had been a stay-at-home parent for many years after I was a social worker a long time ago. And then I stayed home with the kids. And then I decided... I kind of ended up subbing at one of my children's preschools, and I ended up really liking that. So I, for the last several years, I've been a teacher at St. Columba's Nursery School up in Northwest DC,
How many children are in the class?
So we have 14 usually in the classes that I teach.
And
with
you're
Mike
the only Cohen. Person?
No. I have a partner teacher, so there's two of us. But
and do you do the same thing every year?
No, actually,
do you have
we
projects?
Do. No, we actually, my partner and I try to come up with new things to do every year. So we have right now we're studying buildings, and we're creating an enormous building out of gigantic boxes across the back of our classroom. So I'm kind of inspired by that building in Montreal, the Habitat 67. So giant boxes. If you can imagine it, the goal is for us to be able to go inside it. Yeah, it's so fun.
My children missed out. They missed the boat. They weren't raised by you. Do all the other preschool teachers think, I can't do what they can do?
No, well, that's the irony is I feel that way about them.
Are you part magician, part holy worker?
I don't know about that, but I certainly love it. So I'm kind of blessed to have found my way there. So.
And when you look back at your history, you've always had your healing hands. You started as a young person in a mental health institution.
Yeah, when I got out of college, I ended up as an AmeriCorps worker in New Jersey at a mental health center working with chronic mentally ill people. And then I became a social worker. And I did that for a number of years working with more acute clients. And I know it wasn't the greatest fit for me, but after I started taking care of my kids, then I sort of fell into the teaching, which I really like.
You are a whole organic thing. You're doing, your heart is leading you.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate, I think, too.
Well, in addition to that, in addition to being the author of the award-winning Dictionary of Air and a chapbook, Good Housekeeping, his poems have appeared variously, the Southern Review, Poet Lure, Tinderbox Poetry Journal, Gargoyle, Tar River Poetry, and many other journals. And he's had many fellowships from the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities. How do you get many?
So every year you can apply. I haven't been applying recently, but I...
Every year you can apply?
Yeah. So what you can do is apply for... it's like a grant.
I liked them when I lived there. Mm-hmm. I really like them. They were merciful. Well, you can keep applying.
Yeah, I'm going to apply now that I have this book coming out. My book comes out in January of 2027, so I'm going to apply again. I took a break during since the pandemic because I kind of felt like my family was pretty fortunate, but a lot of people I felt like allow other people to why do I need to apply for that, but. I think I'm going to apply this year, partly because, I have this book coming out. So.
But do you have to have a proposal or a fellowship?
Yeah, what you do, I mean, it's really, really generous of them. You basically show that you're a working poet mm-hmm. or whatever art form you do, that you're serious about it and that you have, you give them a writing sample and you also explain what your publishing history is and then they decide.
I hope you get it again every year. You don't want to break your record.
Right.
Let's hear some poetry.
Okay. So my next poem is, if you know Washington, if you've ever tried to drive here and you're not from here, you will find that you will get lost trying to get around usually. So this poem is called La Fonte. And La Fonte was this French, I think he participated in the Revolution. And then he was enlisted to design Washington. He's a French architect or city planner, something like that. And he was a Mason. So the city is kind of laid out with Masonic occult ideas. And so anyways, I think you can get...
It's like rays of a sun in a way.
Yes, it has all these different... structures about it, but you could get lost if you're not from here. La Fonte. It's okay to get nowhere for days. This wasn't obvious when we started out. We thought there was a map, only we didn't have it. The map itself had to be located. And then after looking for some time, we came to wonder if we needed a map to locate the map, and in turn, directions to that one. The man who designed Washington believed ancient geometries, occult and divine, dictated where things should go. Good would radiate from the plan. Therefore, it's impossible to find your way around. you must expect to wander.
This is so in keeping with your idea of always being new and always not expecting. It's very Buddhist, actually, not to have expectations and to find and to notice things. So in a way, you're describing your own journey, I think. You are a wanderer.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that. Yeah, just.
What do you think it is? What do you think a wanderer is?
No, I think. I mean, and that's an old idea too in Christian theology, the notion of being on a pilgrimage and not knowing the Christians know that they're going to back to God, but when you're in life, you're a pilgrim from somewhere, from where you came that you don't know to where you're going that you don't know. And you live your life between those things.
Wouldn't that be good if everyone knew that?
Well,
then they wouldn't start wars. They wouldn't have these planned objectives. They would just be good.
It's funny that you should say that. I was just, I don't know, being in a government building, if I'm allowed to say things like that. But yes, I think there would be less of this.
Doggedness.
Yes. Yeah, we'll use that as a euphemism for what's happening right now.
Yes, and that we sit in the most beautiful government building in the world and that it is surviving.
Yeah.
Through all the chaos is something.
Yeah.
It's something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go on. I should tell them again, Jason Gephardt, Dictionary of Air, available now?
No, not until January of 2027. Yeah.
And then it will be on Amazon.
Yeah, it'll be on Amazon. It'll be. So my kids all like classical music. They're all musicians, and I am not. And I like rock and roll, and they hate it.
How did that happen?
Well, I think it's just you're always cursed to the generation after you has to rebel against you.
My daughters have really neat closets.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that.
My son's that way too, and I am not neat. But anyhow, so they told me this story about Tchaikovsky, and apparently he was the Russian composer and conductor, musician, and apparently he had some serious mental illness, and believed that when he was conducting, that his music could become so intense that his head could fall off in the middle of the performance. I don't know if this is a true story, but I love the story. So he would conduct with his hand on his head and his conducting wand in one hand as he did it. So this is called Tchaikovsky. It's another prose poem. Dreaming is a dance. There are specific moves, a grace in unawareness. And no one can come with you. If there is a beat, it's because you've installed a drum. If there is a violin, you must have taught yourself. Whole orchestras of you have been known to surface just to perform a master's lost ballet, unknown to all but your body, and only for that portion of one night. There are even canons, and you conduct one-handed. The other hand presses down hard on the crown of your head, for fear it will loose and fly off.
I will never, I'm going to look at that and see if he really did have his hand on his head.
Yeah, Google it.
I can't wait.
Well, we'll see. I think it'll still, even if I'm proven wrong, I think the first ball will be okay.
Fabulous.
So I'm back to verses now. This poem is called On Three. And I have, it's for a friend of mine who's a wonderful poet, Rachel Cloud Adams. She one time in a workshop chastised me for ending a sentence on a preposition, which she wasn't enraged as the poem says, but I was sort of exaggerating. So hopefully she'll forgive me for citing her here. On Three is the name of the poem. On Three. Take my friend. She was enraged when I ended a sentence on a preposition, sad for the word I'd left dangling. Anger is a secondary emotion, like how green doesn't exist without first blue and yellow. I too have empathy for the language I speak. It's not easy to hold on to an edge. My therapist once drew a triangle, a stick person at each corner, She left the faces blank to fill, as the future would require. Me, that preposition, my friend's syntax. The triangle is the most stable of shapes. Push against any corner, and it resists. This is why God is three-personed, and the clover is not four-leafed. Why the famous never die, one or two at a time. Why we always go on three.
Oh, that is true.
Yep. This next one is sort of I think if you have enough money to fly on an airplane, you will have had this experience, being in that tube between the terminal and the plane, and that's where this poem takes place. It's called The Bear. In the long and narrow jetway, suitcases roll, rumble, then halt, rumble. Yes, boarding now, love you, says a woman into her phone. Most of us are quiet, solemn even, like a carefully guided herd. Death, a fiery one, I always think a little of at this point, or plunging into the ocean. What's going on, huffs a man, or I think in small portions of death. Just as the petite mort is a tax on orgasms, and the camera steals soul slivers in exchange for images, DC to LA in hours must cost more than money. Ahead, passengers shipped abruptly to the side of the tube, something parting them. Then I come to it, on the floor a shaggy brown bear, its ears still slick from a child's mouthing. The dark glass eyes seem to hold us as we pass, offering back reflections too small to make out.
You know, the object is so important, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The object in the poem, it just has such a vibration. And of course, the poet was the only one who noticed it. Everybody just walked over it. Yeah. But the writer has to see everything, right? Mm-hmm. And you do. You know, yesterday I asked my workshop what they thought was important and mm-hmm. why poetry was important. I mean, it sounds like a cliche question. Everyone was very thoughtful and gave marvelous answers.
Uh-huh.
And so why do you think it's important?
Well, I guess I feel of it almost as, in a way, kind of like an instrument for being in the world in a way, like a way of kind of relating. I also feel for me, it's a practice, it's a work that I do, you know, like I get up and I do it, you know, I try to do it every day and whatever comes or doesn't come. And, I just feel like it's, I mean, everybody I think has a way that they connect and, I don't know, for me, it's a spiritual practice, to be honest. I mean, even if I'm writing about something that doesn't seem that way.
It is. And why is it a spiritual practice?
I think it's a lot like, for instance, prayer or meditation. And it's a way of relating to, like I was saying, for me, I think it's a way of relating to not knowing. You know, I don't know.
That's great.
Yeah. So.
It's a relationship to not knowing. That's it. Well, it's not the best one, but it's getting good. And I think that it's the only language form that really shows what is human, deeply human. I mean, prose doesn't always, it can make you feel things, but poetry is really the only art that shows our humanity. I mean, it's from the soul, right?
Right. Well, I think it's always an attempt to reach something that can't be reached. So whatever you
so
come
so what are
with
we the, doing?
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. What you have shows up as a fail is always a failure, right? It's never the thing. It's like you never, you just don't, you can't reach it. But I think that the poetry is the thing that comes. I think comes closest.
To
like
being.
I said, like it's like the Zen master said, you know, not knowing is the most intimate. That's as close as you can get. And
we
related.
Keep writing that every day.
Yeah, I think so.
Let us have a final poem.
Okay. So this this poem is the one I had referred to that has the line in it that is where the title comes from. And you know, if you're at home with a small child, you spend a lot of time just puttering around and watching what they're doing and not really understanding, you know, what is going on in their mind, you know, what's going on. And there was a period of time, well, I read the poem about J. Edgar Hoover where we were toddling around and the cat came up. Well, there was a period of time when my youngest son would walk around the neighborhood and he would have to stop. He would have to pick up a stick, and he said in his, you know, 2-year-old language, you know, that we had to stop and we had to nectarine the tree. And I'd be like, all right, Francis, we're going to nectarine the tree. He would grab a stick and he would very methodically go around the circumference of the tree stump and tap, 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 tap with the stick, and then he was done. Of course, if he had to nectarine all the trees, we could be there between where we were in the store we were going to. It could take, like, you know, 2 hours to nectarine all the trees. So this poem is called Nectarine. Nectarine. It's good to not know what you're doing. A reminder, you're just visiting from somewhere. When my 3-year-old says he's nectarining the oak, don't ask how nectarines figure in. Let him delight in picking the perfect twig. Follow as he rounds the trunk, tapping its bark. You're visiting from somewhere you can't describe. Why rush to the next place, then the next? Stop and let the tree need this from him, like the bloom needs the bee's casual brush. Good to know the fruit, but not the tree. Let nectarine pass through the dictionary of air.
Oh, my heart. Before we sign off, I want you to tell us about your collection of poems in the shape of states. I think blue states, maybe. No, not all.
No. In fact...
Tell us about the shape. So, now, I want to tell the audience that these poems are on the page, and if you read them, they're in the exact shape of, like, Florida. And so tell us.
So, again, I'm in a government building. I'm going to fess up if that's okay. I picked all the states that Obama won in 2012 that Trump flipped. I was writing them shortly before the 2020 election. I mean, I had gone out and I had, you know, I had done the phone calls. I had written I'd written my letters to people in Florida. I did everything I could. But the last thing I thought was, I'm just going to put a hex on this guy. I'm going to poetically hex him by writing these poems. So I picked them and I deliberately picked the shapes. And I meticulously, it's really hard. Try Michigan. Try writing a poem in the shape of Michigan. It nearly killed me. And it worked. The outcome of the 2020 election was... okay, was much better than, you know. Then I wrote one for California because I love California and I have roots there. The first one I wrote actually was by accident, was Georgia many years ago. I was writing and all of a sudden I looked at it and I said, oh man, this poem looks like it's in the shape of Georgia so far. So then I wrote till it did look like Georgia.
Oh,
so that's where I came from. That.
So name the states that are, but we can, but when you get the
okay,
book.
Okay, so Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, Florida, Wisconsin, I think. There were 6 of them. And then I had California and Georgia were my other ones. I miss anybody?
Yeah, you're right.
Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania is also.
Right.
So.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and that was the voice of Jason Gephardt. We want to thank the library for making the program possible. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation, the Sinipid Fund, Natalie Canavor, Sandy Jackson Cohen, Avi Deshashani, Young Ki Kim Renault. Our engineer is Sandy Kinlock. I'm Grace Cavalieri.